Hi, and welcome to the Norwalk Hour. I'm Brian Burgess, and we'll start with a front page article from the Wednesday, March 6th edition, headlined, Lyft Driver, Norwalk Cop, Testify in Trooper's Trial. This front page article by Ethan Fry and Liz Hardaway. Two different men pulled guns during incidents involving Mubarak Soleimani on January 15th, 2020, prior to his fatal shooting by State Trooper Brian North in West Haven, a jury heard on Tuesday. The first was a rideshare driver whose vehicle was stolen by Soleimani in Norwalk before the 19-year-old, whose family said he suffered from schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, led police on a chase up Interstate 95. The second was a Norwalk cop who responded to the area while Soleimani was stealing the rideshare driver's vehicle. They were called to the witness stand on the second day of testimony in North's trial on a single count of first-degree manslaughter with a firearm in connection with the January 15, 2020 shooting on Campbell Avenue. The Lyft driver, Daniel Green, testified that he was afraid for his life during the incident. Green said that he stopped his vehicle at a gas station after Soleimani slapped him in the head about a block away from where Green had picked him up, an AT&T store where Soleimani had alarmed employees and shown a knife. Green said that he pulled a legally owned pistol he was carrying and got out of his car, then tried to order Soleimani out. "You were scared for your life," North's lawyer, Frank Riccio, asked. 100%, Green said. While Green was standing outside the car, a Norwalk police officer who had been dispatched to the area, Daniel Vasquez, pulled up and also pulled his gun. But Soleimani calmly got out of the rear of Green's Hyundai Sonata, got into the driver's seat, and left. He looked at the officer, smiled, and just drove away, Green said earlier while being questioned by Inspector General Robert Devlin. North, the first Connecticut law enforcement officer charged in a fatal on-duty shooting in nearly two decades, rejected a plea offer in the case, calling for a sentence of up to 10 years in prison, with a right to argue for less time behind bars. A tense atmosphere is expected for the trial, with more than 30 people filling the courtroom's public gallery on Monday and Tuesday, including several members of Soleimani's and North's families, as well as several state troopers. If found guilty, North would face up to 40 years in prison, five of which would be mandatory. Also on the front page, Trakonis lawyers said $6 million bond will take some time. This article by Liz Hardaway and Pat Tomlinson. After a jury found her guilty in the Jennifer Dulos case, it remains to be seen whether Michelle Trakonis will be able to post the high bail amount imposed by Judge Kevin Randolph on Friday. He set Trakonis's bail at $6 million after a jury convicted her on charges of conspiracy to commit murder, tampering with evidence, and hindering prosecution. Trakonis remained in custody on Tuesday at York Correctional Institute in Niantic. John Schoenhorn, Trakonis's defense attorney, said Tuesday that it will take a while to put together a bond package for his client. "I do not see that as happening this week," he said when reached by phone. Schoenhorn also said that the $6 million is the highest bail he's seen for a client not charged with murder. Schoenhorn said that he saw his client on Monday. He said that she has not been able to make phone calls, speak with her family, or a pastor she knew while living in Avon. However, Schoenhorn said he anticipated those conditions would change on Tuesday. He said Trakonis may be able to see her family, but she is only allowed to have up to two visitors. Since Randolph increased Trakonis's bond by $4 million after the jury returned the guilty verdict, her family would have to contract with a bondsman for 7% of that amount, a payment of about $280,000, Schoenhorn said previously. They also have the option of paying 10% to the court, which means $400,000 in cash, not assets such as real estate, according to Schoenhorn. Typically, with larger bails, like those exceeding $500,000, bail bondsmen require 7% of the bond as a down payment, plus $150 and some sort of collateral equal to about half of the bond amount, according to Leroy Weber of Invictus Bail Bonds. Bail bondsmen could require collateral with bonds as low as $100,000, but a number of factors could influence how the bond is executed, Weber added. If Terkonas is released on bond, Randolph ordered that she be under house arrest and GPS monitoring. Terkonas was first arrested on June 1, 2019, and charged with tampering with or fabricating physical evidence and first-degree hindering prosecution. Those charges were related to the Hartford surveillance footage that captured her with Fotis Doulos making a series of stops along a four-mile stretch of Albany Avenue the night Jennifer Doulos was reported missing, police said. Terkonas was released on a surety bond through ACES bail bonds in Bridgeport on June 3, 2019, court records show. The second arrest occurred on September 5, 2019. Terkonas turned herself in to state police and was charged with tampering with evidence. She was released on a $100,000 surety bond that same day, also through ACES bail bonds in Bridgeport, according to court records. The third arrest occurred on January 7, 2020, when police charged Fotis Doulos, Terkonas, and attorney Kent Mawinney in connection with Jennifer Doulos' homicide. Fotis Doulos faced new charges of murder and kidnapping, while Terkonas and Mawinney were each charged with conspiracy to commit murder. Terkonas' bail was set at $1.5 million. She was bonded out on January 9, 2020, by Angel Khan of Alibaba Bail Bonds, court records show. In August 2020, the state filed more charges against Terkonas, including two additional counts of conspiracy to commit tampering with evidence. Prosecutors also removed one charge of first-degree hindering prosecution and added a second-degree hindering prosecution charge. In a front-page article by Mike Anthony, people think he's crazy. Cam Spencer is a perfect fit for Dan Hurley, UConn basketball. Cam Spencer has been at the University of Connecticut for well under a year and in a UConn basketball uniform for just 4+ months. But if snapshots and anecdotes accurately depict his everyday emotional charge, there's been no player who better embodies what it looks like and feels like to be so deeply ingrained in Coach Dan Hurley's program. Spencer was disconsolate, unapproachable, after losing a three-point shooting competition during the Huskies' annual preseason first-night celebration. He is said to punch walls while upset with himself for missing shots in practices. Spencer is no less animated during games, of course, taunting opposing fans during UConn's victories, screaming and forming an L with his thumb and forefinger at St. John's, and playing with a general swagger and scorn that pushes the boundaries of athletic aggression, using some timely shoulders to initiate a near scuffle and technical fouls for others at home against Marquette. "That dude is shot," Hurley said recently. Weeks later, Hurley added, "He's sick," but quickly smiled at the irony. Who is Hurley, after all, to judge? There haven't been many coaches who push the needles toward an emotional red line with every stomp up the sideline quite like he does. This clearly was a perfect match, a coach-player-mentor-student relationship between two guys, both well-traveled for a white-knuckled climb up the college basketball ladder, both sometimes doubted along the way, who seem to understand that any level of success only creates a platform to prove something else to the world at large. Their brains are twisted in the same obsessive, competitive braid. Because of that, Spencer knew quickly that UConn was the perfect fit as he considered his next program out of the transfer portal last summer. Everyone involved in the process did. "I don't even know how to describe it, but it was the first time as a mom that I felt like, besides Cliff Reese at Boys Latin, somebody saw Cam's intensity as a positive," said Spencer's mother, Donna Spencer, referencing her son's high school coach on the north side of Baltimore. "Some people think that's crazy, or he's crazy, or whatever. He is who he is. You better know it going in. I hope you can temper some of the foul language, some things as a mom where you'd like. Please don't do that. It's hard." But nobody at UConn saw any of that as a negative. They thought, "We could use this energy." And that was such a positive for me and for Cam. Spencer, a graduate student from Davidsville, Maryland, is averaging 14.8 points for the third-ranked and Big East regular season champion Huskies, just behind team leader Tristan Newton, at 15.3. He's shooting 49.7% from the field and 45% on three-pointers, adding daggers to the UConn offense in the way Jordan Hawkins and Joey Calcaterra did during last season's national championship run, and adding the leadership flair of Andre Jackson and Adama Sanogo, too. "Everybody in this program values Cam and loves Cam," Hurley said. "We've all experienced everything that we're going through in college this year. But Cam hasn't. We love our brothers here, and we want Cam to experience what it's like to be top of food chain in college, playing in the biggest games, making a run in March, competing for championships. Because nobody deserves to play in these types of moments more than Cam, with what he's brought to us. Just the drive, the passion, the competitiveness, the will that he's instilled in this team after losing some junkyard dogs that we had last year." In other front page news, a student is to be the Senator's State of the Union guest. This front page article by John Moritz. In a high school lecture hall last month, Cheyenne Raghu opened up to U.S. Senator Richard Blumenthal about her struggle watching a younger family member become lost in their cell phone screen to the point that they were spending up to 10 hours a day on the device. On Thursday night, she will take that story to the halls of Congress. Raghu, a junior at New Britain High School, was selected by Blumenthal to be the senator's guest at President Joe Biden's 2024 State of the Union Address, to be delivered Thursday in the chamber of the House of Representatives. Members of Congress are typically permitted to bring one guest to the president's annual address, which they watch from the House gallery. In addition, Raghu will also accompany Blumenthal to a dinner with other senators and their guests in the U.S. Capitol. "I want them to hear firsthand, as I did from Cheyenne, how social media is harming young people today with eating disorders, bullying, suicidal thoughts, self-harm, all of the harms driven by social media at young people, so that they can profit," Blumenthal said. "I wanted her to tell my colleagues about what she sees and hears, and what its impact is on her friends, her fellow students," he added. Blumenthal is one of two senators leading the push to pass the Kids Online Safety Act, a bill that aims to increase regulations on social media companies and offer parents greater control over what content their children view online. About 2 weeks before he met Raghu and her classmates during a roundtable discussion at New Britain High School, Blumenthal participated in a fiery hearing in which senators from both parties berated a panel of tech CEOs, including Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, over the amount of negative content that's fed to teenagers on their websites. "It is truly a privilege to have been chosen to represent the voices of students across the nation, especially in such a critical issue as kids' online safety," Raghu said during a short press conference Tuesday at her high school. Raghu, a member of New Britain's junior ROTC program, thanked both her advanced placement government teacher and ROTC leaders. Raghu also told Blumenthal that she aims to attend one of the U.S. military service academies after graduation. "I am committed to continuing to advocate for the safety and well-being of young people everywhere, both online and offline," she said. Blumenthal's guests at previous State of the Union addresses have often included members of the military and veterans. His guest for last year's address was Fairfield resident Alex Plitzes, a veteran and former defense official who helped organize the evacuation of Afghan refugees. Other guests of the Connecticut delegation this year include Neville Daly, a State Department of Social Services employee from Waterbury, who will be the guest of U.S. Representative Johanna Hayes, and Jerry Fisher, the retired leader of the Jewish Federation of Eastern Connecticut, who will accompany U.S. Representative Joe Courtney. Also from today's front page, in an article by Jessica Bravo, nearly $100,000 raised for families of two killed in I-95 wrong-way crash. Nearly $100,000 has been raised for the families of two longtime friends who grew up together in Norwalk and were killed in a wrong-way crash on Interstate 95 last week. The women, 22-year-old Samantha Burchard and 23-year-old Jolie Sierra Lubin, were among four people who died in the West Haven crash on February 25th. Police said Burchard and Lubin were passengers of a Nissan Altima that 25-year-old Hussein Alili was driving when they were struck head-on by a Chevrolet Silverado pickup truck that was going the wrong way. The driver of the Chevrolet, 26-year-old Thomas Bulkley, was also killed, along with everyone inside the Nissan Altima, police say. Two other people who were in a third car involved in the crash were also seriously injured. Samantha and Jolie brought joy and laughter into the lives of everyone they touched, the GoFundMe said. Unfortunately, their lives were cut short. Burchard and Lubin grew up in Norwalk together, and they had been friends since the first grade, according to Lubin's mother. They really supported each other, Heather Lubin said. They really loved each other. Burchard was working as a substitute teacher in Greenwich after recently graduating from Roger Williams University in 2023, her obituary said. She lived in Norwalk, where she graduated high school. Lubin's obituary said that she attended University of Vermont and Western Connecticut State University and had been working in sales for Nissan. Lubin was recently living in Trumbull. As of Monday afternoon, the GoFundMe had raised about $95,000 for them. Your generous donations will go directly toward easing the financial strain of these funerals, allowing the families to focus on grieving and healing during this incredibly difficult time, while also helping us create a lasting tribute in their memory, the GoFundMe said. Last week, officials gathered at the Rocky Hill Department of Transportation facility to discuss the recent fatalities in highway collisions, some stemming from wrong-way crashes. Too many people are being reckless, putting themselves and others at risk on our state's roadways, says State DOT Commissioner Garrett Eucalito said. Seven fatalities, including the West Haven crash, have occurred in the state this year from three wrong-way crashes reported. The families are facing the overwhelming burden of arranging two funerals, a weight no parent should ever have to bear, the GoFundMe said. Lubin had a wake on Friday, according to her obituary. There was no further information if there were any burial or funeral plans. Burchard's obituary said that she would be buried on Tuesday, March 5th at 10 a.m. at the St. Matthew Church in Norwalk. Also in Norwalk, Bob's is to close one Norwalk store and open another one. This article by Paul Schott. Bob's Stores will close its Norwalk location this week, but the apparel and footwear retailer is planning to open another store in the city within the next few months. Company officials have confirmed that Sunday will be the last day of business for Bob's Stores in the shopping center at 380 Main Avenue, off exit 40 of the Merritt Parkway, where it has operated since 1996. Bob's has held a closing sale there since last summer. In the spring, Bob's plans to open a new store at 542 Westport Avenue in Norwalk that will carry Bob's and Eastern Mountain Sports merchandise. Bob's and EMS are owned by the same parent company. The new Bob's EMS store will operate in a storefront that previously housed a Bed Bath & Beyond store, which closed last spring. All employees at the current Norwalk store will transfer to the new location, according to Bob's officials. Among other locations, Bob's closed on January 28th, its store at 889 Post Road in the Fairfield Shopping Center. Bob's officials have said, however, that they are planning to open a new store in Fairfield. We are currently in the process of identifying the ideal location, Kevin Campbell, Executive Vice President of Operations for Bob's Stores and EMS, said in a written statement. At 889 Post Road, Restoration Hardware has signed a 35,000-square-foot lease for an outlet store to fill the space formerly occupied by Bob's. Fairfield-based True Commercial Real Estate, which was one of the brokers of Restoration Hardware's lease, is now listing the 47,000-square-foot space in the shopping center in Norwalk that houses Bob's. That storefront stands between Stop & Shop and Total Wine & More. A message left for True Commercials asking about potential new tenants for the closing Bob's storefront in Norwalk was not returned. In addition to the changes in Fairfield and Norwalk, Bob's last year expanded its network in Connecticut. In October, it opened a store at 835 Queen Street in Southington. And in August, it returned to Hamden with the reopening at the Hamden Mart Shopping Center. the same site where it had closed the store in December 2020. Within Connecticut, there are also Bob's locations in Ansonia, Manchester, Middletown, Milford, Newington, Simsbury, Waterbury, and Waterford. There are two EMS locations in Connecticut, a new store which opened on February 28th at the Danbury Square Shopping Plaza in Danbury, and a store within the Bob's establishment at the Crossroads Shopping Center in Waterford. Bob's is a homegrown business for Connecticut. It was started in 1954 by founder Bob Lapidus with a single store in Middletown and eventually expanded to 27 stores throughout the Northeast, according to its website. In other news, this has been a real problem. Norwalk blighted properties are to face steeper fines under new rules. This article by Catherine Lutke. Penalty fees for blight violations in Norwalk have increased, now ranging from $150 to $1,000 a day. A change to state law has allowed towns and cities to increase the penalties for blight, explained Lisa Shanahan, chair of the Ordinance Committee, during the Common Council meeting last Tuesday night. This has been a real problem in our districts, Shanahan added. I think all of us, Common Council members, have had different complaints from different aspects of our neighborhood, so it's really important that we address this. In addition to the fine increase, Norwalk's Common Council refined what blight is and added a definition for commercial blight. The changes went into effect immediately. Now, with the addition of commercial, we have the ability to work with folks in different neighborhoods addressing different businesses and being able to focus on that, said Jessica Vonischak, chief of the Economic and Community Development Department in Norwalk. We worked really hard to be able to define blight differently, Vonischak added. By clarifying what blight is, the city will be able to better enforce the ordinance and fines, Vonischak said. That is really important because it allows us the opportunity to enforce differently and enforce in a more progressive way that helps us define what blight is and what is not. Now, the fine for a blighted property that is occupied is $150 a day, up from $100 a day, until the violation is corrected. If a property is vacant, the fee increases to $250 a day. We actually see the majority of our blighted properties are owned by banks or third-party companies where the home has gone into foreclosure and the bank is sitting on the property, and it's actually vacant, which is why the yard is growing or the fence is falling down, Vonischak said. The revised ordinance also allows the city to issue a $1,000 fine a day for properties with a chronic issue, meaning they've been cited for blight 3 times in the year. In October, the city announced a new blight enforcement inspector and zoning enforcement inspector to form the city's neighborhood specialist team. This team would work to cite blight and zoning violations proactively, while the existing blight and zoning enforcers will continue to handle the reports the city received. We have been ramping up with the neighborhood improvement team, Vonischak said. We've been ramping up enforcement and how complaints come in through City Hall. We've been working on different approaches to be able to work with community members to understand what problems properties are out there. The Common Council unanimously voted to enact the changes to the ordinance, but Council President Darlene Young, who represented South Norwalk, said she thinks more should be done to strengthen the ordinance. I'm hoping that the impact will be meaningful for communities, but my concern is the definition of blight for commercial property as it pertains to contractors, Young said. Young noted that sometimes properties double as commercial and residential in South Norwalk. I think there is more to do, Young said. In an article by Ken Dixon, Mayor says New Haven is on track to become the largest Connecticut city. Bills aimed at trying to fill the state's need for as many as 100,000 new dwelling units drew support on Tuesday during a day-long public hearing before the Legislative Housing Committee. But while Republican state lawmakers from Fairfield County defended the incremental increases in affordable housing opportunities in their suburban towns under a controversial 35-year-old state housing law, New Haven Mayor Justin Ellicker pointed to 1,900 new units in just a few years, with another 3,500 planned as his city of 139,000 is on track to become the state's most populous, displacing Bridgeport within 10 years. "We're growing, and we're growing fast," said Ellicker, one of 70 state and local officials and residents registered to testify on a variety of housing-related bills. Suburban lawmakers, led by Senator Tony Hwang of Fairfield, Representative Tom O'Day of New Canaan, and Senator Ryan Fazio of Greenwich, defended their districts, where some of the most expensive homes in the state are located. Hwang, whose district includes Bethel, Easton, Newtown, and Weston, said that much of Easton contains a lot of the regional supply of drinking water, which should be considered whenever housing mandates are discussed in the legislature. "Not doing anything doesn't solve the crisis that we have," Hwang said, stressing that the 1989 statute called 8-30G, which established requirements for affordable housing units in municipal development, has failed. "I want to make clear that in Connecticut we have a housing crisis," Hwang said. "We do have an incredible challenge in the state of Connecticut as it relates to access, affordability, and equity. We also need to understand that density building doesn't fit in every community. The idea of watershed communities to be able to protect them from density building, sewage capacity, septic capacity, is an important consideration in regards to quality water, but also to environmental impact." Fazio said that in the off session, a group put together by Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff of Norwalk and House Majority Leader Jason Rojas of East Hartford kept a positive public dialogue on the issue going. "I think we're in a weird situation where we have this very adversarial state statute that is making communities very unhappy because it's sort of reducing their input on decision making," said Fazio, whose district includes parts of North Stamford and New Canaan. "We put the localities in charge, we get the best results," Fazio said. O'Day, whose district includes parts of Darien and Stamford, pointed to New Canaan Parish, a 300-unit municipal-owned development in his hometown. "The state statute 8-30G is the number 1, 2, and 3 issue in New Canaan and Darien because it can have such a dramatic adverse impact on surrounding property owners," O'Day said. "Builders have proposed affordable housing, then negotiated it away, so at the end, there is no affordable housing. Affordable units, they don't make money on. The predatory nature of what is going on in New Canaan, Darien, and much of Fairfield County has resulted in zero affordable housing being built in New Canaan since the 1990s. The Housing Committee's deadline to approve legislation is March 14th, and the General Assembly adjournment is midnight on May 8th. And in an article by Catherine Lutke, a Norwalk City employee is honored among top young engineers in New England. The Assistant Director of the Transportation, Mobility, and Parking Department has been named one of New England's top young professionals by Engineering News Record. "Garrett Bolella is an asset to the city of Norwalk, and we are grateful to have him on our team," Mayor Harry Rilling said. "He's managed several innovative transportation projects and has helped pave the way toward making Norwalk a safer, more sustainable community for our residents. His dedication, professionalism, and expertise are exemplary and well-deserving of this outstanding recognition." Since joining the staff in Norwalk in 2021, Bolella has been dedicated to improving mobility in the city for all residents. Some of his projects include the Wall Street Corridor Master Plan and Complete Streets Ordinance. "I am also very grateful for the opportunity to execute the mayor's vision to further transportation choice in Norwalk and play a pivotal role in building upon what is one of the most livable cities in the nation," Bolella said. Before working in Norwalk, Bolella was the lead traffic engineer in Stamford, where he promoted a bike and pedestrian plan for the city. In today's Life Tribute, Winifred Schaefer Chesley of Wilton passed away on Wednesday, February 28th. And that is all the time we have for today. I'm Brian Burgess, and I've been reading from the Wednesday, March 6th edition of the Norwalk Hour. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.